Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The things falling apart for the White Sox. It was an incredible play.
No way.
You gotta be kidding me.
Those two up the middle in that alignment, just tremendous.
This looks like it's more of a Bears Browns game.
Fly ball to center field. Oh, Davis didn't see it. Now it's over his head, and he makes the catch!
Holy
incredible!
Smokes.
What a recovery for Rajay Davis.
No doubt about it.
The 0-2. Swing and a high drive. Deep right center. There she goes. A game winner. Carlos Santana with a walk-off towering blast to right center. And the Indians have done it.
And that fastball is clobbered to deep left field. And it is gone off the facing of the second deck.
There goes 3-2 pitch hit to right field. In comes Carrera.
He dives, can't make the play. And Naquin's going to be able to score from first base.
Naquin slides in safely. Davis has a triple. And the Indians have cut the lead to one. Here's his pitch to Rajay Davis, who ropes one to left center. That gets down for a base hit. And it skips past Pilar. It goes to the wall.
So he's one hit away from the cycle. And that's the easy one, the single.
Swung on. Line drive. Base hit into right. And Rajay Davis has hit for the cycle. And the fans here recognize it. They are giving Rajay Davis a big hand.
So here in the 19th,
the 3-2 is hit hard. Deep center field. Back is Pilar, and it's gone. Carlos Santana puts the Indians on top. Finally, the Cleveland Indians of 2016 have set the franchise record with their 14th consecutive win. And oh, baby, did they earn it.
Carrera drives one in the air, deep in the left center field, way back, and that ball is way gone. Oh, Carrera killed it. Tigers have a 2-0 lead.
Driven deep in the air to right field, way back. This one is going to go. It's a home run for Saltalamacchia. Number 100 for Jared Saltalamacchia in his career.
And it's a big one, too.
And again, the 2-2. Swing and a miss. Down he goes. Bouncing ball to second. Gensler. Throw him out. Runner goes. And a swing and a miss to strike him out.
Boy, Fulmer's looked dynamite tonight.
They see Victor Martinez, who swings on the first and drills it to left field. That ball is up there, and that ball is in the bullpen and gone.
Welcome back, Victor Martinez.
Fly ball left field. This one's deep. Going back, Eichner at the fence, looking up, and it's gone.
High fly ball right field. That ball's hit pretty good. It's going to the track. It's going to the wall. And Victor Martinez has hit another. Martinez's third home run of the night.
Here's Upton.
High towering fly ball center field. Hit deep. Martin back. And that ball is gone. Dustin Upton has just hit a bomb. And the Tigers have taken the lead.
And Upton will lead it off here in the bottom of the 12th. 7-7 ball game.
Driven deep to left field, way back and gone! It's a home run for Justin Upton, and the Tigers have a walk-off win. He did it again!
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the extravaganza. We are live here at Highland Meadows in Sylvania for the opening round today of the LPGA Marathon Classic. It is just such an amazing place to be this afternoon. I got to tell you, the people who are working here, the people of Sylvania, the people of Northwest Ohio, you know what, I was talking to the guy who took me over from the media parking lot here to the clubhouse and out to the media tent where I am right now. gave me a nice ride, a retired gentleman. And he just, hey, how you doing, sir? And he said, oh, just having a ball. And I said, so you work for the class? He goes, oh, I'm just a volunteer. He told me about all of the volunteers. And he said, they don't just live in Sylvania. They don't just live in Toledo. They don't just live in Northwest Ohio. He said, quite frankly, they come from out of state to volunteer for the Marathon Classic. And that is just such a great thing. Because I got to tell you, I've been to a lot of remotes. I've been to a lot of sporting events. I've broadcast from many golf courses and PGA Tour events as well throughout my nearly 20 years doing this job. And I got to tell you, the hospitality that they have shown here at the Classic is second to none. The professional facilities, just about everything. So we are live here at the Classic this afternoon for the extravaganza. We have a lot of things we're going to talk about today. First, I want to say thanks to 1 Hour Heating and Air Conditioning and Ben Franklin Plumbing. They are responsible for our presence here at the Classic. And we are having a very good time, and we're going to continue to do so between now and 5 o'clock. Jim Cushlin is holding down the fort back at Studio Central. And, Cush, thank God in heaven above for the relief that we got from the 90-plus degrees earlier in the week. And it is perfect out here, absolutely gorgeous, even outside of this air-conditioned tent that they've got for us due to our broadcast.
Yeah, no kidding on that one. And it'll be interesting how the week goes.
Jim, I mean, can't hear
there's
you, my
more
friend.
There's more calls for possible storms and stuff later in the week, but it shouldn't affect anything for these first couple rounds of the Marathon Classic, which, of course, is underway as we speak.
Yeah, real hard to hear you, Jim, so I don't know what we got to do there, but it was very, very hard to hear anything that you just said other than something about storms. It's the only word I got out of all that. So we work out our little technical glitches and bugs that are in the little system as we go from Sylvania back to our studio and vice versa. But we've got a lot of things that we are going to talk about today. While Jim and I work out our little communication difficulties, I will tell you that we are going to talk a little baseball, if you couldn't tell from the montage that Jim put together. I said to Jim and I talk every day, obviously, you know, before the show, about what we're going to talk about. And we talk about what we should have in the opening montage to set the scene for the issues that we want to discuss. And he said, what are we going to do? It's Thursday. It's still the All-Star break in Major League Baseball because the teams don't start up again until Friday. There's no NBA. There's no NFL. There's no NHL. College football hasn't started yet. What are we going to do? There's no action. There's no play-by-play. There's no audio or sound or interview sound to play for the montage. What are you going to do? I said, geez, Kush, I don't know. And I paused and I thought about it and I said, wait a minute. You just said it yourself. It's still the All-Star break. The second half of the season starts tomorrow. A, we need to do a second half MLB preview, and B, We just need to recap the first half. Let's do a little montage, a little Indians and a little Tigers from the first half of the season, and we'll kind of set the table with that. And that's what Jim just did. So you just heard a couple of minutes of the highlights of the first half for the first place Indians, and some highlights from the kind of tied for third place Detroit Tigers, and or second place, I guess is what you would say, because the Tigers and the Royals are kind of neck and neck for that, and then the other is third, and then there's the White Sox kind of half game behind them. So we're going to do that. Dennis Mantloff will join us with a little Major League Baseball preview in about 45 minutes or so. Maybe we'll call it 50, about 4:05 after the top of the hour Sports Center at 4. So we're going to talk baseball with him. And we are, despite a lack of games being played yesterday or things like that to react to and to discuss, we are going to talk a little college football. And we're going to talk about it in the context of the SEC. I was just talking to Rachel Lindsay out here at the media tent. Rachel is covering the tournament for the Toledo Blade. She is, of course, the beat writer for Michigan football and basketball for the Blade. And we have her on many times during football season. We were just chatting about Big Ten Media Day, which is coming up, I think, in a week, Jim. Isn't it about a week from now?
Yeah, it's two. Check it out. The Mac Media Day is July 28th, so it's 2 weeks from today.
All right.
So that there you go on that one. And actually, incidentally on that, we're also going to have some interesting things that day, too. Before you, we're going to have a little special show. Mark Beyer is actually going to be out at Mac Media Day for a couple of hours, 1 to 3 before the extravaganza. So that's going to be very, very interesting. Get a real interesting lowdown of Mac Media Day. Usually we just end up saying, oh, well, here's what the media ends up picking and some other interesting things that may be going on with the Mid-American Conference, for example, but this one's going to kind of be more interesting. We're doing a little extra effort for this one, so I'm interested to see how that works as well. So it should be kind of fun. Definitely, yeah. Kind of fun.
Yeah, and Jim, I don't know if you can still hear me there or not. I'm having some more technical glitches on my end. Can you pick me up? Are we all good?
I got you.
Okay, good. But yeah, we're having just all kinds of technical problems. My apologies for that, but we will work our way through that. So anyway, the point about Big Ten Media Day, and you just mentioned the Mac Media Day that Mark is going to be at, and this brings us to SEC Media Day yesterday. And this is one of those things that Big Ten fans, and if you're in Northwest Ohio and you're an Ohio State fan, or you're a Michigan fan, or even a Spartan fan, or maybe, I don't know if it's quite as much, there's quite as much bias or, I don't know, resentment of the bias for the SEC for Notre Dame fans that Big Ten fans feel. Big Ten fans of the Spartans and the Wolverines and the Buckeyes can't stand all of the SEC bias nationally. And I don't know if Notre Dame guys fans feel that or not, but for those who like when bad things happen to the SEC, then you got to love what happened at the SEC Media Day and then on the SEC Network shortly thereafter. SEC Media Day, Alabama head coach Nick Saban, who's about as lovable as, I don't know, a porcupine. He's different than Bill Belichick in a couple of unique ways. You know, neither one of them like the media. Neither one of them are particularly gracious when talking to the media. But one of them likes the attention. He just wants the attention to be all positive. See, Bill Belichick couldn't care less if he was ever on TV again. Bill Belichick, who is not a lovable guy when it comes to the media, will just as soon, you know, stare at you, make you feel stupid, and then give you a couple of grunts and say, okay, well, we're moving on to Philadelphia. Yeah, we're looking on to Philadelphia. Well, right now we're preparing for Philadelphia. He'll just mumble his way through, you know, some sort of non-answer and just hope you go away. So he's similar to Saban in that he doesn't like the media, but Nick Saban is very different from Bill Belichick in that, and there's other people you could throw in, but those are the top two that come to mind. Nick Saban actually likes attention. He likes the attention that he gets, or that he can get, for being 14-0 and being national champions, for being the highest paid coach in college football, for having the best recruiting class. If media members want to put him on the radio or on television and praise him and kiss his behind for his general overall awesomeness, boy, he's your best buddy and your best pal. That's Nick Saban. But if media members want to put him on and then actually challenge him on something, then he becomes more Belichick-like, except instead of just mumbling through non-answers, he's ready to fight. He's that guy. How dare you kind of a guy. The kind of guy who says, I don't care what you say, I don't care what the media says, you don't know anything, I know everything, while yelling for 15 more minutes about the media, proving that he does indeed care about what the media says. And that's the kind of situation we found ourselves in yesterday. SEC Media Day, Nick Saban is making a speech. He's describing how he and his coaches, his fellow coaches at Alabama, have decided they're not going to suspend left tackle Cam Robinson, who's supposed to be an extraordinary, he's an All-American. He's going to be one of the top draft picks next year. He's a big, big part of their team, literally and physically. Literally and figuratively, I should say. He's big in stature, and he's big on the line, too. But he's a star. And he was arrested, Cam Robinson was, along with another player, Hootie Jones, defensive back Hootie Jones. And they were arrested back in May after being pulled over in the early morning hours with two other individuals. And when the police pulled them over and smelled marijuana and saw a bag of marijuana on the floor of the car, then also found out that there was a an illegal firearm, in fact, stolen firearms in the car in the possession of these individuals. They were arrested. Robinson was released on bond. Jones released on bond, one of them a little higher than the other. But all that happened in May, and over the course of the last 2 months, obviously. This was May 17th. From May 17th to here we are now on July 14th, the question is how's Alabama going to handle this? You know, these are two important players charged with marijuana possession. That's one thing at 2:23 or 2:33 in the morning. But being charged with possession of a stolen handgun as well as with the possession of narcotics, now we're talking felony. And those charges were filed in Louisiana. According to Louisiana state law, punishment for a conviction on stolen weapons possession calls for jail time of not less than a year, not more than five. That's pretty big. Well, turns out the prosecutor in Louisiana decided not to file those charges. And so, therefore, Alabama is kind of in a much better position. They were arrested. They acknowledged that they had said items, guns and drugs, but they were not charged with the crime. Prosecutor dropped everything. Don't know why, but it's okay. Alabama now is faced with how do we discipline in this situation? Well, yesterday, Media Day, Nick Saban announced, well, we do open up with USC, you know. We do have a pretty doggone big game to start our season. We're not playing, you know, Appalachian State. We're not playing Southwest Texas State University. We're playing USC. By the way, we're not suspending these two guys after that arrest. Paul Feinbaum asked Nick Saban, not during the press conference, it's during his press remarks when he was announcing this. He asked them about it when he stopped by the desk, did Saban, on the set of the SEC Network. Paul Feinbaum, a very, very knowledgeable and well-respected college football analyst for ESPN and an SEC honk, if ever there was one, decided to ask Nick Saban, okay, let's talk more about these two guys that you are not suspending. Is that really the best look you want for your program? To say that Saban didn't appreciate the question or the insinuations or the follow-up question is an understatement. Jim Cushlin, if you have that, let's hear it. Okay, I guess we don't have that. If you do, let me know, Jim. Oh, we do have it. Okay, let's try that now.
A lot of people, bad look for your program that you're working out internally but not suspending them publicly for an important game against Southern Cal. How do you answer those critics?
Well, I don't really care to answer the critics because I'm going to do what's right for the players. And if the players really did anything that wrong, they would have got charged with something. All right. So,
well, I mean, that's debatable if you listen to what the district attorney said in his simply unintelligent response.
Didn't say what all was. Like, there were four people in the car. Why did the two football players get arrested and the other guys not get arrested? All right, there's no law about concealed weapons in Louisiana. Is that right, Marcus?
That's
you're
correct.
From Louisiana. All right, so why did they search the car just because there was a gun on the
seat?
Do
you think they were persecuting the football players?
I don't. There's just a lot of questions there that are reasons that there weren't charges brought against these guys. Now, we're going to do every... Now, do we condone the behavior? No. Right, but you're innocent until proven guilty in this country, regardless of whether you get convicted in the media or not, which is what you're doing to these players.
I'm not convicting anyone. Right. I'm just asking you why you are not going to suspend Cam Robinson for the Southern
Cal.
Because
I'm not going to convict him in the public. And you said that I was going to get criticized by you and the public and the media because I'm not going to suspend him. And I don't really care about that. It's the end of the conversation.
Okay.
Well, that was the end of the conversation as far as the on-air portion of the conversation goes. But after they went to commercial break, that is when the conversation got even a little bit more heated. Now, we don't know what was said because the video that has emerged all over the Internet on all of the sports sites, the video that has emerged, it was taken kind of from a corner in the room about, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 feet, it looks like, based on the vantage point of the camera, away from the actual set. So you cannot hear the audio of what Nick Saban is saying, but you can sure read the body language. Saban stood up from his seat next to Feinbaum and proceeded to dress down the ESPN college football analyst with arms flailing in the air, gesticulating, and according to witnesses who were on the scene who could hear it, lots of F-bombs and other four-letter delicacies for Paul Finebaum about daring to ask if this is a bad look for his program that he's not suspending these two players. As I said leading up to that, when you have college football coaches who love the media and love the attention as long as it's positive attention, but then loathe the media and proclaim they don't care what anybody says because you don't know the facts or anything else, when the media is actually challenging them, and then they go on to make a jackass of themselves, it's not a good look. Forget about the look about Cam Robinson not being suspended and everything else. It's not a good look for him to be that defensive. When you say you don't care, then say, you know what, I'm right, you're wrong, and thank you for having me on, and don't care, go right ahead. But if you are going to say that you don't care and then act for the next 10 minutes like you doggone well care what people are saying about your program, it just does not reflect well on your program. So I just think what happened with Nick Saban is typical Nick Saban. His ego is constantly, and I do mean constantly, getting in his way. It is either making him look like the pompous, conceited, you-know-what that he is, or it is, well, I guess that's kind of almost just it. You know, the other way his ego gets in his way, of course, is that, you know, it's not about arrogance and it's not about the actual perception. It's just, you know, how do other coaches view him? How does that impact their preparation for him and so on? Everybody wants to beat the crap out of Nick Saban, far more than they do Urban Meyer or Jim Harbaugh, some of the other prominent coaches with strong egos and strong personalities. But the question for sports radio's purposes that I would like to discuss with you on this particular case is, after having made very, very clear that I side with Finebaum, and by the way, I also, because I learned this today when it comes to this issue, Finebaum should be praised greatly, in my view, for the way he handled this entire thing in this regard. Finebaum could have waited and gone on his radio show. Look, I've been in this business for almost 20 years. And I know when you're sitting in the seclusion of your own radio booth or studio and you're miles away from anybody that you're actually talking about, it's easy to say this guy's that, this guy's that. I mean, I've called for Isaiah Crowell to be cut from the Cleveland Browns over his incredibly incendiary, offensive, inexplicable post about killing policemen. On Instagram, I responded to that by saying from the comfort of my chair in my studio, he should be cut. And he's a punk, and he's a thug, and he has forfeited his place on a team that I like, that's for sure. And there's a lot of guys, that's all they will do. They'll say it from the comfort, they would never say it to somebody's face. Well, let me say two things. One, if I ever had a face-to-face interview with Isaiah Crowell in the wake of all of this, I would tell him to his face, you need to be gone, released, cut, you are gone. You do not deserve to wear the uniform, you do not deserve to cash the multi-million dollar paychecks, you do not deserve to have kids trading your card away. That was inexcusable, and it is irredeemable, especially without something sincere as an apology. I would tell him that face-to-face. Paul Finebaum didn't go onto his radio show and rip Nick Saban for the bad look for the Alabama program from miles away. He waited until they were not only on the same studio set together, they sat next to one another. And Paul Finebaum just looked over at Nick Saban and said very clearly, is this a bad look? Or some are going to say, this is a bad look for your program. These two guys were arrested with guns and drugs in their possession, stolen guns and drugs. The fact that they weren't charged doesn't change the facts of the case. Why are your players driving around at 2:33 in the morning with guns and drugs in their possession? You need to set some sort of an example here and show what your program is all about, show what your program stands for. That's kind of what Paul Finebaum was saying. How are you going to answer that? And for Saban to go off the way he did, well, you know, it wasn't comfortable for Finebaum, but I give him all the credit in the world. This is just kind of a shop talk thing from a radio host who, this is what we do. This is what we do. We get paid to give our opinions. We get paid to analyze things and give our opinions on what we've analyzed. I like to think that most of us do a good job of researching the things that we talk about before we give our opinions on them. Otherwise, you know, we're just a caller. And that's no diss on the callers. But the reason we do what we do is we study it and we formulate opinions based on researchable facts, right? But by and large, we give opinions. And some of those opinions are not always pleasant. Sometimes those opinions offend people. Sometimes those opinions aggravate and irritate listening audiences. Paul Feinbaum gave an opinion right to the man's face and was willing to take it. And by the way, acknowledged, and this is the worst part of the story for Saban, and I just have to throw this out there again because I don't mind, I really do not mind embarrassing the SEC and saying things that kind of let you know what they're really all about, because they always operate seemingly with the impunity of, hey, that's the best conference in college. They deserve every benefit of the doubt. Whether it's a playoff, you know, a college football playoff ranking or top 25 ratings, et cetera, they always get the benefit of the doubt. So I don't mind ripping on the SEC. So the worst part about this for Nick Saban is after it ended, that wild George Costanza-like gesticulation of, I just can't believe I just said that. Christian, are you a Seinfeld fan?
I used to watch it every now and again, so I'm aware of what you're trying to
do. Do you know the one
there?
I'm talking about when George Costanza was Coco? And, in the office, they gave him the nickname Coco, and he was mad because he wanted the nickname T-Bone, and he was in the hallway while everybody else was standing in there waiting for lunch.
I do vaguely remember that one, yes.
And he was jumping around, and the boss on the other side of the glass said, "Look at George giving it to T-Bone over there, boy. He's jumping around, arms all waving," and he also, because it was lunchtime, he was holding his lunch, and he had a banana in one hand. He looked like some kind of deranged monkey. And so anyway, he comes in and wants to tell everybody that he's now going to be known as T-Bone. And the guy says, he says, "I will now be known as," and the boss says, "Coco the monkey." Anyway, I know I'm just getting off on a little pop culture tangent there, but that's what Saban looked like, just kind of waving his arms all around and gesticulating.
Yeah, that is totally true. That's such a good point on that one. It really is. It does bring back that. I'll admit, because I haven't watched a lot of Seinfeld recently, that was not my first thought. But now that you're mentioning it, that's pretty dead on.
There it is, and that's what it reminded me of. But anyway, we do, you know, again, there's no audio from the video that you know, appeared, you know, that was shot from the corner there. I don't know who shot it. But the witnesses were on the site or on the set said that, Saban was accusing Feinbaum, was telling Feinbaum that the officers who pulled his players over in Louisiana did so because they're LSU fans. And when they pulled them over and then chose to arrest the two players but not the two other occupants of the car, did so to hurt Alabama because they're LSU fans. That's how deranged Nick Saban really is. That's how unbelievably deranged he is, that he thinks that these officers are going to try to file charges against two young men with their seasons and their careers and their reputations on the line just because, hey, maybe it'll help the Tigers. Are you kidding me? Well, just for the point of reference here, and I know it's 3:34, we got a Sports Center coming up. I just want to get this out. Just for the point of reference, the police in Louisiana heard that that accusation and wanted to respond, and did so, informing Nick Saban that no, the officer who stopped, the first officer on the scene there who stopped that car that led to the arrest of those two players, is not, in fact, an LSU fan. In fact, doesn't like the colors yellow or purple. And in fact, there isn't even anybody that he can think of on the staff or in the department that is an LSU fan. And that this accusation that somehow they would do something this dirty just to promote a football team is about as low as it gets. And you know what? They're right. I'm looking for the actual quote. I'm having some technical glitches out here at the Marathon Classic. We're at Highland Meadows in Sylvania. I'm trying to find the quote from the officer. I'll tell you what. I'll take that time out. And then I'll read it to you direct. Oh, here it is. Never mind. Got it. Here's what it is. This is trying to give you the name of the officer who responded here. And it is proving to be very hard to find. And once again, I apologize because it looks like I'm not going to be able to have it before we take the break, and I'm stalling to see if I can do this. Now I can. There we go. Here is he's the PIO, the Public Information Officer for the Monroe Police Department in Louisiana. And his name is Chris Bates. And he said, I can tell you for a fact that the first officer on the scene is not an LSU fan. He hates LSU. He doesn't like the color yellow or purple and gold. In fact, he's a Florida fan. If you mention LSU around him, he throws up in his mouth. Most of our officers are LSU fans, so I guess I got that part wrong. He said, but we have some who are Arkansas fans and Georgia fans and Alabama fans. And I'll tell you this, the first officer did not even know those guys were players. But Feinbaum apparently told, Saban told Feinbaum that these were clearly LSU fan officers who were just trying to drag down the Crimson Tide. Feinbaum told reporters that, and reporters, of course, ran with it and just wanted to make sure everybody knew what an absolute lunatic that Nick Saban is. All right, so Hootie Jones, the backup defensive back at Alabama, is not going to be suspended. Cam Robinson, who is their left tackle and an incredibly highly ranked one as well, he is not going to be suspended. And Nick Saban, it says it's because the prosecutor didn't charge him. If the prosecutor didn't charge him, then they didn't do anything wrong. Never mind that part about stolen guns and drugs at 2:30 in the morning being in their possession in the car that they were driving around with. That's not necessarily a great look, but just don't tell that to Nick Saban. Okay, let me get that time out here. Once again, we are broadcasting live. This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza. So happy to be here out of Highland Meadows and really taking full advantage of all of the gracious hospitality of the good folks at the Marathon Classic, this tremendous LPGA event. Thanks to Jim Heller, who is running all things media here, by the way. He's just providing us with great information. We'll give you an update on the leaderboard here coming up. But we are brought to you by One Hour Heating and Air Conditioning and Ben Franklin Plumbing, live at the Classic in Sylvania. We're going to talk a little baseball, get a second-half preview as we are in the final day of the All-Star break. The Indians and the Tigers both back in action tomorrow, along with most of the rest of baseball. So we're going to get a preview of the second half with Dennis Maniloff here after the top of the hour. Would love you to be a part of the show, too. Dial us up at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, as we continue live at Highland Meadows on the Afternoon Extravaganza on the Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And we do indeed continue on the Extravaganza right here live in the media tent at Highland Meadows, the Marathon Classic. What a wonderful, wonderful event that is being held today. The first round, obviously. Jim going to keep giving you those leaderboard updates here in round number one. I'll be back here again tomorrow. Mike Miller is going to be here both days. He's been here all week, obviously, so he'll be here at 5 o'clock for drive time. And we really appreciate the hospitality of the folks at the Marathon Classic. And thanks to our friends at 1 Hour Heating and Air Conditioning and Ben Franklin Plumbing for bringing us out here to this great event on an absolutely perfect day for anybody. I don't know. It depends on who you are as to what's a perfect day for golf. I personally always like it to be a little bit of a nip in the air, just a little bit of a chill when I'm playing or if I'm watching or whatever the case might be. I like around 70. But I'll take 82 or 83 or whatever it is right now. Kush, I missed your last weather update. What was your current temp?
I got 85 right 85. Now, but it's better than the 90-something we've had recently and will, of course, have again.
Yeah, and the humidity is much, much lower as well. So it is. It's a great day for golf. I think God just looked down and said, I think we're going to really bless the Classic this year and hook you up. So,
and you know, I'm curious as to, and Mike, as he's had all week, will probably have maybe a golfer or two or maybe some updates on specifically that front. I'm curious to see how the golfers are taking to the course today because we did have some storms and some rain actually pass through here, as we all know, yesterday. And that always maybe helps or hinders depending on the golfer when that's on the course. So got wet a little bit last night, obviously it's not as wet and it's not raining or anything right now, but that does change course conditions, so I'm curious to see how that's going through day one. A lot of golfers, you know, sometimes if your terrain's really bad, it takes things out of their game depending on what golfer they are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It depends on what they do. Obviously, if you are a long ball hitter who needs a lot of run, on your tee shots, you want as dry as possible so it doesn't sink and stop. But if you are more of the irons play master and you are and you're looking for balls to stick on the green, well, then the wetter and the softer, the better. So, it'll definitely have an impact, and I'm sure Mike will be all over that this afternoon at 5 o'clock on drive time. Last night, the ESPYs were held. I wanted to get into this a little bit, too. Last night, the ESPYs were held. I'm going to be honest with you. I've never been a big fan. Well, let me say never. For the last few years, I've not been a big fan. It is... I'm not a fan of award shows. You know, and I think that's probably what it is. More than anything else, I've never been a big fan of the Oscars. I've never been a big fan of the 75 different music award shows that are on TV every year. I swear there's two a week. I swear. You know, it, whether it's the VMAs or the MTV Video Awards or the Grammys or the, American Music Awards, the CMA, Country Music Award, there's so many of them, it's just ridiculous. These award shows where they get up there, they pretend to be funny, and then they honor one another, and they tell everybody how, tell one another how great they are. I've never been a big fan. And maybe that's why the, ESPYs have kind of just always fallen down on, for me anyway, have fallen down on a lower interest level because it's an award show. But having said that, there's something else about it that has just bothered me as well through the years. It's just taking itself far too seriously. And I don't mean the cancer part, obviously. God bless everybody who contributes to that event every year, talking about the ESPYs, with raising money for the V Foundation in mind. The Jim Valvano Foundation, obviously the former North Carolina State coach and national champion from 1983, maybe the greatest upset of all times, all of that stuff, who, of course, lost his fight to cancer so bravely, so strong, and never giving up, etc. That part is epic, and that part is wonderful, and ESPN is to be commended for that. Having said all that, though, the award show itself, like all of them, they tend to take themselves too seriously. Well, last night, what the award show did, the ESPYs, what the award show did was go beyond taking itself too seriously. It gave itself, in my opinion, far too much importance, and it did so with far too few, how should we say, facts involving controversies and cases in the United States that would or may change the view of the people listening to them speak about them. I'm trying to be as very careful as I can on this. But they opened the show last night, which I'm sure you saw, with LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Chris Paul, and Dwayne Wade. The four of them standing all, pretty much shoulder to shoulder to open the show instead of with a musical number or something funny and goofy like a lot of award shows do. They did it with this very serious message of... addressing all of the violence in the United States in recent days, weeks, months, etc. And what they did was fine in so far as calling for an end to violence of all kinds. There is nothing wrong with that. Who could possibly disagree with the message of, hey, everybody, let's chill out. Everybody, let's chill out. No more violence. Who would oppose that? No problem. No critique for that. However, in making the call for no violence, in a general sense for the American public and the American sports fans, what those four players did last night was to further a narrative that has been advanced by special interest groups and by far too many in the media that is just simply not based in fact. Simply, flat out, wrong. In fact. Provable in about a billion different ways. Okay? And what that does, rather than expand and grow the movement toward nonviolence, is it creates a lot of anger and a lot of enmity with people who do know the facts and who don't like the notion that the society in which we live is being portrayed in a way that is not accurate, particularly members of different races being portrayed in a way that is not accurate. People who are of a given profession being portrayed in a way that is not accurate. And that's what they did last night. I haven't decided if in the next hour I'm going to play the cuts or not, because they've been getting far too much airplay for my taste, because I don't want to further those inaccuracies. But I will at least describe what I'm talking about. When there is a call for an end to the violence that has everyone in their living rooms nodding along and saying, yeah, love it, great message, guys, and you might be the perfect messengers for it, After all, who do young teenage kids, especially kids in urban settings, who are, you know, oftentimes at the center of the violence that we're talking about, in a lot of inner cities like Baltimore, Maryland, and like Chicago, Illinois, and sometimes in Detroit, Michigan, Cleveland, Ohio, maybe even Toledo, Ohio. Who do these people look up to and watch and recognize and are they influenced by more than LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Carmelo Anthony, and Chris Paul? Athletes. They don't listen to politicians. They listen to athletes. So it's a great thing. But when they take that message and then expand it to suggest that the reason they have to make these statements is because there is some sort of movement against people of color, particularly young men of color in this country, on the part of law enforcement. And when Dwayne Wade reads the names of a whole bunch of individuals who have lost their lives in encounters with police, many of whom were breaking the law and were literally attacking police in the process of those situations, when those individuals are listed as victims of violence, police brutality, and then other names that are read, and we're talking about two names in Louisiana and Minnesota last week, of individuals we just don't know whether the police were acting correctly or incorrectly, appropriately, legally, or not, because the investigations have barely begun, let alone have been being wrapped up. When they read them as if, see, this is an example of more violence being committed by police officers and or white America against young black males or black America, that doesn't help end violence. That kind of speech making on the SB stage, especially given the audience and the number of people, as I pointed out, who look up to and watch LeBron James and listen to every word, and Dwayne Wade and listen to every word, and care a lot about their opinions on these things. That kind of message doesn't help end violence. That kind of a message helps further the division between black and white America and between law enforcement and much of urban America. Because it's simply not true. It is simply not true. Even after investigation after investigation after investigation has been done, after trials have been held, et cetera, and law enforcement officers were found in many of the cases that Dwayne Wade identified to have been absolutely justified in doing what needed to be done in self-defense or in defense of the public against people committing criminal acts, naming those criminals as the victims of police brutality isn't going to sit well with a lot of people. And it's going to further the divide. And it's going to further, unfortunately, violence committed in the name of all of that misinformation. So I'm interested in your reaction to all of that. And I don't want to do a full hour on it. In fact, I'm glad we're going to talk baseball here in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. We're going to talk baseball and preview the second half. But I watched it, and I watched it with a very, very careful eye and listened with a very careful ear, because I wanted to be understanding of what they were saying, and I wanted to be very reflective of what kind of an impact it's going to have on people. And after listening to it a few different times and watching it a few different times since it went live last night, that's what I've come up with. The overall message of, hey, let's cut down on violence is a great one, but that message is completely distorted and it's diluted, quite honestly, when the sub-messages are, when we say end violence, it means stop. What did Dwayne Wade, how did he phrase that? Stop acting as if black bodies and brown bodies don't have value. That is essentially saying this country is racist against minorities. That is essentially saying that law enforcement doesn't show value in black or brown lives. And it's insulting, and it is offensive, and it is inaccurate, and it does not do anything to actually bring people together, which is what they were supposed to have been trying to do with that ESPYs open last night. I want to bring people together. That kind of messaging drives people apart, because it is just so inaccurate. And that's where I'll leave it for now. We may have time to take your calls on that in the next hour, but for now, that's where we'll leave that. Other than to say, tomorrow's program, I can promise you, is going to be extraordinarily deep. Because you know what we're going to do? Is we're going to talk about what happens tonight. You realize that tonight at 8 p.m., on live on ABC and live on ESPN, uninterrupted by commercial, and also streaming on all of their platforms like ESPN.com, they are going to run the president and the people, meaning President Barack Obama, in a town hall forum with the ABC evening news anchor and with an ESPN a female African-American talk show host. They are going to host a discussion of racial relations in the country. And again, why they're bringing that to the sports world, I think, is very, very obvious. You know, something you would think would be discussed on MSNBC or on Fox News Channel or on ABC News, World News Tonight or something like that. But they're doing it on ESPN, I think, for a very obvious reason, because they know this is where they're going to reach the most young people on sports channels who don't watch MSNBC the way many politically active adults might. So that's what they're going to do, and I can already see some of the fireworks happening. What is it now, 4 o'clock almost, 4 hours before it begins. I can already anticipate fireworks at that town hall event. We will play a lot of that for you tomorrow and react from a sports standpoint to a lot of that tomorrow on the program as well. All right, so it's with that we get to our time out here at the top of the hour. It's with that that I tell you we're going to talk baseball and preview the second half for the American League Central, particularly the Tigers and the Indians battling. Tigers had a lot of ground to close before maybe the trading deadline happens at the end of the month, and they have to decide if they're players for real or if they are just pretenders. So we're going to get a little second half preview with Dennis Maniloff, our friend, in just about 10 minutes or so. And this is also a time for me to tell you about your best way to save money when it comes to auto repairs. At LKQ Pick Your Part, you can bring your own tools and pull the parts you need and save big money. It's that easy. Parts from over 1,000 vehicles to choose from in a clean and organized lot. At LKQ Pick Your Part, you can always find new inventory for your car or truck, from transmissions to tires to rims to radiators. Just visit LKQ Pick Your Part today and find the parts you need. They're also always buying vehicles, too. So call 1-800-962-2277 if you have a used vehicle for sale. Do you know that you can save up to 90% on your auto repairs when you do it yourself at LKQ Pick Your Part? You're doing the work, so you enjoy the savings. If you like to work on your car and save money, visit LKQ Pick Your Part. Remember, at LKQ Pick Your Part, all our parts are guaranteed, always. Hagman Road, just off East Alexis Road in Toledo. Sports Center next. Baseball talk coming up after that right here on ESPN 106.5 The Team.
Pereira drives one in the air, deep into left center field, way back, and that ball is way gone. Oh, Cabrera killed it. Tigers have a 2-0 lead. Driven deep in the air to right field, way back. This one is going to go. It's a home run for Saltalamacchia. Number 100 for Jared Saltalamacchia in his career.
And it's a big one, too.
And again, the 2-2. Swing and a miss. Down he goes. Bouncing ball to second. Kinsler. Throw him out. Runner goes. And a swing and a miss to strike him out.
Boy, Fulmer's looked dynamite tonight.
They see Victor Martinez, who swings on the first and drills it to left field. That ball is up there, and that ball is in the bullpen and gone.
Welcome back, Victor Martinez.
Fly ball left field. This one's deep. Going back, Eichner at the fence, looking up, and it's gone.
High fly ball right field. That ball's hit pretty good. It's going to the track. It's going to the wall. And Victor Martinez has hit another. Martinez's third home run of the night.
Here's Upton.
High towering fly ball center field. Hit deep. Martin back. And that ball is gone. Dustin Upton has just hit a bomb. And the Tigers have taken the lead.
And Upton will lead it off here in the bottom of the 12th. 7-7 ball game.
Driven deep to left field, way back and gone! It's a home run for Justin Upton, and the Tigers have a walk-off win.
We talked about the things falling apart for the White Sox. Here's an incredible play.
No way.
You gotta be kidding me!
Those two up the middle in that alignment. Just tremendous.
This looks like it's more of a Bears-Browns game.
Fly ball to center field. Oh, Davis didn't see it. Now it's over his head, and he makes the catch!
Holy
incredible!
Smokes.
What a recovery for Rajay Davis.
No doubt about it.
The 0-2, swing, and a high drive. Deep right center. There she goes! A game winner! Carlos Santana with a walk-off towering blast to right center, and the Indians done it.
And that fastball is clobbered to deep left field, and it is gone off the facing of the second deck.
There goes 3-2 pitch hit to right field. In comes Carrera.
He dives, can't make the play. And Naquin's going to be able to score from first base.
Naquin slides in safely. Davis has a triple, and the Indians have cut the lead to one.
Here's his pitch to Rajay Davis, who ropes one to left center. That gets down for a base hit, and it skips past Pilar and goes to the wall.
So he's one hit away from the cycle, and that's the easy one, the single.
Swung on, line drive, base hit into right. And Rajay Davis has hit for the cycle. And the fans here recognize it. They are giving Rajay Davis a big hand.
So here in the 19th,
the 3-2 is hit hard. Deep center field. Back is Pilar, and it's gone. Carlos Santana puts the Indians on top. Finally, the Cleveland Indians of 2016 have set the franchise record with their 14th consecutive win. And oh, baby, did they earn it, going 19 innings north of the border.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed it is. The extravaganza rolling on right here at Highland Meadows in Sylvania. The LPGA's best on display at the Marathon Classic. What a tremendous event. What a tremendous day here. Thanks to One Hour Heating and Air Conditioning and Ben Franklin Plumbing for bringing us out. Mike Miller is here as well. He's getting ready and warming up in the bullpen. He'll bring you Drive Time coming up starting at 5 o'clock. And we've got a lot of ground to cover in this final hour of the program. Want to get right back into baseball as promised. Even though baseball isn't ready to get back into baseball yet, at least not until tomorrow night, final day of the All-Star break today. So the Indians will resume tomorrow. They're up in Minnesota. The Tigers are going to be taking on the Royals. So Central Division action, obviously. We wanted to get a little bit of a preview of the second half of the baseball season. So we go to our good friend out in Cleveland, Ohio, where Dennis Maniloff covers those Indians and all things Northeast Ohio sports for the Cleveland.com, the Northeast Ohio Media Group, and for his own purposes, as he is the author of a book called From A to Z, From Andrews to Zastittle, one I highly recommend that you pick up. Dennis Maniloff, how you doing, good sir?
Why do you even need guests when you've got those montages like Bush, man? I could listen to those things all day.
Yeah, I could too. Jim does a great job of giving us, a good look back at what has already happened. He asked me that today. He said, "What do you want to put in the montage today? Because no games were last night. There's no NBA. There was no MLB. No NFL. No NHL." And I said, "Well, how about let's look back at the first half? We're sitting here. The Indians and Tigers are in first and second place, respectively, even though the Tigers are kind of always shuffling back and forth with the Royals for second or third. So let's how did we get here? What happened in the first half?" And that's what Jimmy Cushman came up with for us, an outstanding job, as always. You know what he didn't include there, though, Dennis? He didn't include, he ended with the 14-game winning streak. He didn't include the 6 out of 9 losses that the Indians finished the first half with. So why don't we start there as we look at the American League Central and see what's going to happen in the second half. That 6 out of 9 loss, the losing run that they've had, Dennis, anything to worry about? Or is this just, part of 162 and they're going to be just fine?
A little bit of both. I mean, I think, it was disappointing. And I know that they were trying to punt off and say, well, we were tired and all that stuff. And you got beat. And that last four-game series against the Yankees was very disappointing, losing 3 out of 4. One of the things that this little stretch they've had has kind of exposed is the bottom third of their order is not very good. And it's especially bad when Yan Gomes is not hitting, when he's virtually invisible at the plate. So, the Indians have issues. They're not flawless by any stretch. Otherwise, they wouldn't be seeking bullpen help and a bat and, hoping against hope that Michael Brantley gets back.
Yeah, obviously, the Brantley thing is one of those stories where, if you have a sense of when he's going to be back and what kind of a player he's going to be coming back completely rusty as having hardly played at all this season, then you're thinking to yourself, man, it's like making a trade deadline deal for an all-star, a Silver Slugger Award winner without having to give up anything. It would be great to do that, but do they have any idea of what his condition will be, when he will be back, and if he does make it back, what kind of player we can expect?
Bob, anybody who tells you that he or she has an idea is lying, because not even Brantley knows. Okay, nobody knows. You know, they're doing the same kind of thing that they did a couple of months ago, and it, you know, it didn't work out, because once he started playing, he kind of re-injured it and had to start over again. So nobody really knows how this is going to unfold. The Indians have to, I think, proceed as, you know, Michael Brantley's return being a bonus as opposed to something you can pencil in, whether it's August 1st, August 15th, whatever it be. You still have to treat it as a bonus. You can't count on it at this stage because there's been so much uncertainty surrounding it. I will say, though, that the news is trending more positive. I mean, obviously, he's gotten out to a minor league rehab stint, which some of us didn't think was going to happen at all this year, you know, for the second time. So it's trending upward. It's trending positive, but you can't bank on it until you see him play, you know, I guess several weeks in a row without getting hurt.
So that being the case then, Dennis, what do you anticipate happening? It is now July 14, so we are, what, 17 days away from the deadline at the end of the month? What do you expect, you know, the Indians to do? Are they going to go out there and be aggressive and give up some of the wonderful farm pieces that they've assembled over the course of the last few years and make a big run at a big-time bat or a reliever or whatever the case might be? Or do you think they feel like, hey, we've got the second-best record in the American League. We've got a pretty comfortable lead even after struggling at the end of the first half. We're built to win it as is. What do you think they do?
I think the former. I think they're going to be aggressive. They're going to try to add. They realize this team is not a dominant team by any stretch and does need some assistance. You know, that's not to denigrate their standing or, you know, their lead or what have you. It's simply to say that there's room for improvement. And, you know, they can get better. They can afford to upgrade offensively. And, you know, so I think they'll be looking there, of course, with the bat and obviously with the reliever, a guy who will come out and can be, you know, almost feel like a guaranteed out for the opposition. The Indians really don't have that. But here's the thing, though. The Indians have to make a decision on where they draw a line in terms of, you know, which guys are not going to get moved. And I think, you know, that line is drawn at Zimmer and Frazier, their two top position player prospects. But it may also include Tyler Naquin. Naquin has become a fascinating case because, you know, not only is he a prospect, but he's got major league at-bats and he's performing at the major league level. So he's a former first round pick. So there's that, you know, going for him. He's played well enough that I'm sure he's attracted the attention of non-contenders. And if the non-contender inquires about Naquin, are the Indians going to be willing to part with him?
And what do you think the answer to that question is? I see a guy like that, Dennis, and I see, you know, this is the kind of bat, and I know he's very young, so understand for what it is, but I mean, the way he has played since he has been getting regular at bats, he's the kind of guy you trade for, not a prospect you trade away in order to get somebody better. He has been extraordinarily productive.
That's a tremendous point. That's why I've been trying to say around here, Bob, that it's a quandary. Now, I hear some people say, oh, if you got to trade Naquin, you have to trade him. Well, it's easy to say, but when you watch him hit and some of the home runs he's hit, the backspin that he gets on the ball, you can't teach that. You know, he has power that I never saw coming. And, again, am I putting him in the Hall of Fame? No. Is he automatically going to be great over the course of 162 games? No. But he's shown you stuff that, you know, makes your eyes open, you know, especially on the power side. And he's still, you know, very young by baseball standards. I think he's miscast a little bit in center field. I think he'll wind up in the corner, one of the corners in his career, and that's why some of his defense has been shaky, because I don't think he's made to play center. But the offensive game and the speed element as well, it's going to force the Indians to make a very difficult decision, because as you know, Bob, in this market size, with this budget that, you know, the Dolans have, you can't just jettison your top farm guys or your top young guys. You need to replenish from within, and Naquin is an example of a guy coming up through the pipeline that you drafted who's now contributing at the major league level. He's helped you get in first place. So do you want to subtract that? I don't think I wouldn't.
No, I got to tell you, I wouldn't either, Dennis. And I want to ask you this because, and I'm not saying they're the same guy, obviously, but I'm just looking at what Tyler Naquin has done, and I'm trying to find the number of at-bats he has had thus far. Do you have his stats in front of you by chance?
I do not, Bob. I'm sorry. I was hoping Kush would come up with him.
Yeah, I'm out here at the Marathon Classic here at Highland Meadows,
okay,
in Sylvania, so I don't have access to everything. No, that's okay. We don't need to know specifically. No, it's okay. We don't need it specifically. The only reason I was asking how many at-bats is I'm looking at the results. I'm looking at a guy who's hitting .314 with 9 home runs and 22 RBIs, and I wanted to compare that to where Francisco Lindor was last year when he came up at the same number of at-bats, if we could find that. Maybe Kush can dig that up or not. My point being, people would have been ballistic if we had been in the same position. I say we, I'm an Indians fan, everybody knows that. And we'll talk Tigers in a couple of minutes as we talk about the entire American League Central. But Dennis, you know, when you look at where Lindor is today, and last year, if the Indians had been in a similar position in first place and needing to trade a rising young star type player or star future star type player to get an established guy now to make a run, people would have gone haywire if they had said that. And I think, just guessing now because I don't have stats in front of me, that Naquin's production and his track, if you will, and his ceiling, if you will, is probably pretty similar to what we saw at the same stage last year from all-star Francisco Lindor.
Yeah, I don't have the direct comparison on Lindor, but Naquin's played 58 games. He's got 50 hits, 7 doubles, 5 triples, 9 homers. Talking about 21 extra base hits in 58 games.
And 22 RBIs.
591. So... you know, so here's the thing, Bob. I am not going to sit here, and neither are you. We're not comparing the two as prospects, okay? Because clearly Lindor was regarded as virtually a can't-miss prospect.
Correct.
That was not the case with Naquin, okay? And plus, you know, Lindor plays a premium defensive position, which separates them anyway. But, you know, nobody is comparing Lindor to Naquin. But your point is that the production that Naquin has brought through the first 58 games of his rookie year kind of resembles that of Lindor's. And if you had even thought about moving Lindor, you'd have been crazy. You know, I hear you. And
I just want to clarify, you know, and you said it, thank you for clarifying it, so nobody thinks I'm an idiot like that I'm comparing Lindor to Naquin specifically as prospects or players. Point being simply that last year he came up and outperformed anything and everything that anybody expected of him, speaking of Lindor, and I think the same exact thing is happening now with Naquin. Does that mean that next year Naquin will be an all-star the way Lindor is this year in his second season? I'm not saying that. Just saying that the way a franchise like that builds a championship caliber roster is to take those guys, develop them, and grow with them, not jettison them, you know, for a veteran player going into a contract year that might help you now. It may or may not help get you to a playoff position, a division title, or a World Series, because you can't afford to let those guys go.
Right. It's easy and it's sexy to say, oh, you know, go trade for the veterans. But let's just use an apples-to-apples example. You know, let's say you were to trade Naquin in a package that brought you Jay Bruce, okay? Well, everybody says, oh, yeah, Jay Bruce, bring him in. Yeah, he's the man. Well, you got to guarantee me that Jay Bruce is going to be as productive in 2016 for the remainder of the season as Naquin has been, okay? I mean, this is not like you're subtracting a player who is at Triple A or Double A and hasn't played a game in the major leagues. You would be subtracting in Naquin a player who has helped you get to first place. He's made a significant contribution to your roster. You don't usually see contenders trade from their major league team because, logically, the major leaguers on that team were the reason you're in first place. Well, guess what? Naquin's one of those guys. So he fits not only the prospect build, but he also fits the build of he's helped you win. So I think they have to be 100% positive that Naquin is not going to blossom as a player before they move them.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And you know, you mentioned Jay Bruce just to throw a name out. Obviously, you know, he's available with the Reds being as bad as they are. You know what, actually, before we move on and talk about other players that they might be targeting or other positions they might be looking at, Jim Cushlin, you do have the 58-game numbers now.
Right.
For what Francisco Lindor had at the same time.
Yeah, this is the 58 games from last year, because I'm going with his first 58. So first 58 games for Lindor in 2015. 284, 319, 388 for average on base slugging, 5 homers, 24 RBIs, and a couple of stolen bases.
So, Jim, I heard most of that, but not all of it. Give it to me once more, please.
All right, the slash line, 284, 319, 388 for your batting on base slugging, 5 homers, 24 RBIs, and 3 stolen bases through 58 games last year for Lindor.
And we were blown away by that because we weren't expecting that. We were expecting great glove and adequate bat who could hold a spot in the lineup, not being the number 3 hitter and the most productive guy you've got. Now, the difference, of course, D-Man, is we have hindsight now. We know that he extended that beyond 58 games. He did it for his entire rookie season and has improved upon it now for the first half of his sophomore season. You can't project that Naquin is going to do the same thing, but it does give you reason to pause and say, you know, we got a guy who's outperforming what Francisco did last year in his rookie year. That's not somebody we want to say goodbye to in a rush to try to get somebody in here now.
Right, and not only that, again, he's your first round pick from a few years ago, so that counts for something when you have to build from within. And here's the other thing, Bob, you know, you've got 9 homers. I've charted virtually every pitch of every game the Indians have played the last 3 years. I've seen his 9 homers, and 4 of them, I'm sitting here going, wow. You know, like 4 out of the 9, I said, man, I can't believe that he hit that ball out, including 2 to the opposite field. And that kind of power is not something that's easily disposed of, okay? Especially out of a young guy. You never know, is this real? And honestly, Bob, I was at the ballpark the other day, and I talked to a handful of people, and the opinions on Naquin varied 180 degrees, or 170, whatever it is, 90 degrees. I mean, a couple of guys said he's a good one, you got to hold on to him. A couple of guys said he's not going to get any better than he is now, which is pretty good. But they said he would eventually, you know, tail off, and he would kind of recede back to that non-superstar-type prospect status. And then another guy said he'll be an average player. So the opinions on Naquin vary dramatically.
Dennis Mantiloff is our guest as we do a little preview of the second half of the Major League Baseball season in the American League Central. Let's move on to the rest of the Central, Dennis. Obviously, we spent a great deal of time on the Indians because you were there and because they were in first place by 6.5 games at the break. The question now is looking at the Tigers and the Royals, and I guess since they're only a half game back of them, the White Sox, who, if any of those three teams, is the most dangerous and the most poised to cut into that deficit that they face, to cut into the lead that the Indians have, and try, whether it's through a move at the deadline or just improve play with what they've got, to catch the Indians and make a, you know, a real horse race out of this over the next 2.5 months?
In my opinion, it's definitely going to be the Detroit Tigers. Listen, I don't want to dump on the Royals. I vowed I wouldn't do that coming into this year. That's why I picked them to win the division at the start of the season, because they have my respect. You know, they've been to the last 2 World Series and won last year. However, the loss of Moustakas for the year, the loss of Gordon for an extended period, the loss of a couple of their free agents, such as, you know, their trade deal guys like Cueto and Zobrist, that now leads me to believe that the biggest threat to Cleveland is Detroit. And I'm looking at Cleveland's schedule, and I think that this division is going to be decided in that final series, or the penultimate series for the Indians at Detroit, September 26th to 29, 4-gamer. Interestingly enough, the Indians go on to Kansas City to play 3, so quite the meat grinder to close the year for the Indians at Detroit, at Kansas City for 7 games. I think the Royals will hang around because they're they got too much pride in their system to help them out. But ultimately, I think this comes down to Detroit versus Cleveland.
Detroit versus Cleveland, and then the question is, as you look at the Tigers roster, you know, they're gonna have to make a move to close that gap at the deadline. And quite frankly, there's a few different kinds of needs. You know, we don't know exactly, and Jim Cushion can certainly speak to this too, being here in Toledo. You know, he watches the Tigers very, very closely. We don't know exactly what J.D. Martinez is going to be when he gets back, if he's going to be the guy that bombed out 33 homers last year and they got off to a great start this year, or do they need to go get some lineup help, or the starting pitching, which quite frankly, due to injury and performance, is a mess. I don't know, Jim, you know, looking at Toledo and looking at the Double-A level, what kind of prospects they have to bring in the one or maybe more pieces that they need to really bolster their run at the Indians. Jim, do you have any thoughts on that before we go back to Dennis?
The only thoughts on that I have is, you know, they've kind of given away some of these guys over the years, and some of the ones that are left are now doing things in Detroit. See Michael Fulmer, see Stephen Moya, and if I'm a different GM, I'm asking for those guys, but if I'm Al Avila and that gets questioned to me, I'm probably hanging up the phone because I'm not getting rid of either of them. Tigers are in a tough place because of the various trades they made over the last couple of years during season and off season, that there's not a whole ton of big-time prospects that other teams simply want right now. They just don't have it.
Dennis, go ahead. Your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, it's always hard to acquire decent starting pitching, too, you know, at the deadline. So it's going to be difficult for Detroit to do that without having to chip off some important pieces, probably from their minor league system. But listen, when I look at the Tigers, I look at that lineup and I say, I mean, I can't even imagine what that lineup would look like with a healthy Martinez, a JD. And, you know, when you have JD Martinez in there with Kinsler and Castellanos and Vic and Miggy and Upton, I mean, oh my goodness, that's why I have the reverence for the Tigers that I do. Because I think they can mash, and I think they will bludgeon teams to victory. What I think the Tigers will look at is they'll say, all right, let's not panic here. We're still within shouting distance of the Indians, and we have that outlier in their minds of a record in the season series, which is 1-11, okay? The Tigers can sit there and say, if we play really well against the rest of baseball, we just happen to play horribly against the Cleveland Indians. And I know you could say, you know, 11-1 is not a fluke. I'm not saying, or 1-11, however you view it. I know that that's true. It's not a fluke, but the Tigers can say, you know, if we perform better against the Cleveland Indians, we'll be okay because look at our record against the rest of baseball.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And it was astounding what the last series that they had, it was pointed out, you know, after the Indians had won their 11th straight before they finally broke the streak at the end of that last series. And what was the number, Jim? What was the exact winning percentage against the rest of baseball? Wasn't it like 650 or something?
It was around there.
650 baseball against everybody else, but then 0-11 against the Indians put him at 500, which is like just, you know, inconceivable that could be the case. Now, the good news for them is they only have seven left against the Indians, so they don't have to worry, you know, if they keep playing that way against everybody else, you know, they're in a good position. But the bad news is they only have seven left against the Indians, and they got a 6.5 game gap to close. The Indians are built pitching-wise to keep that lead. The Tigers are not, and as you point out, they're going to need to add starting pitching before the break, or before the deadline, I beg your pardon, if they're going to be able to close that. Let's get away from all of it for a minute or two here, Dennis, before you go, and just look at the American League as a whole. Who's the best team in the American League heading to this trade deadline, and who is your new favorite, if it has changed since the start of the year, to go to the World Series?
Well, I was convinced it was the Texas Rangers until they stubbed their toe against the hideous Twins. In Arlington, of all places, at the end of the half, right before the break. I still believe Texas is incredibly dangerous. You know, they're loaded offensively. They've got really good pitching, even with Darvish being in and out of there. I like the Rangers as the class of the, not only the West, but of the American League. I think Baltimore is very good because they can hit and they have that incredible bullpen. So I have a lot of respect for them. You know, I said, again, before the year, I said that and Kansas City was my pick to repeat. I even had them going back to the World Series and playing the Giants, because it's the every other year thing with the Giants, as we talked about, and sure enough, the Giants look great, by the way. But in the American League, has my thought process changed on a favorite to get out of the American League? Probably yes. I would shift from Kansas City to Texas.
And then what about the National League? Who's the best team there? I mean, I think it is just going to be a phenomenal run. Wow, you didn't even wait. You didn't even let me say the name Nationals or Cubs. I know the Cubs were not as good as they played for the first 2.5 months or so, but they're very good. I also know that the Giants are not as good as they're playing right now, which is extraordinarily hot. The Washington Nationals, to me, look like they might be as good as their record is. They look to me to be the most complete team, not the hottest team, the most complete team that can do the most damage, in September to get there and then in October when they get there. But you didn't hesitate. You said Giants. Why?
Well, number one, I respect the Giants' talent and the way they can, they beat you in a lot of ways. They have really good starting pitching. They have an absolute dominant ace in Bumgarner, who has incredible historic postseason numbers. So you feel like in any series, as long as you've got Bumgarner out there, you're going to win a few games. Not only do I respect the Giants' talent, but I also believe in the idea that the experience that they have, the ability to close out both seasons, in 10, 12, and 14, will pay off again. It's not just because of the every other year, although that's an interesting, certainly an interesting storyline, but that confidence that you get from having won it in three of the past five or three of the past six is huge to me. And so if I've got the Giants going up against either the Cubs or the Nationals, I like the Giants' chances, because they say to themselves, you know what, we've done this before, there's no reason we can't do it again, and we have a ton of confidence when it comes to October.
Yeah, it's a really great point about their experience being there, and that does play a large role. The Cubs, of course, have had many, many years where they felt like this was it, and then, of course, it isn't, and maybe they start to feel the pressure of the moment a little bit more. The Nationals, I don't know why, but they feel like, to me, and I don't want to use the cheesy, cliche team of destiny term, it's the long term anyway, but I just mean, I think what they're doing now is what they were expected to have done last year. As you know, they were the trendy pick. I picked them to go to the World Series from the National League, and of course they ended up choking one another in the dugout. And they're doing now what they expected to do last year. I feel like maybe the better cheesy cliche to use here is unfinished business. I feel like this is their time. It was supposed to be last year. I don't think they're intimidated. I think they're a little brash at times. They're not going to be choking up and feeling the pressure of the moment the way that maybe the Cubs were. And if anybody can maybe take it to the Giants and their composed, we own late September and October type of MO that they have, if anybody can do that, it's going to be those Nationals. And I'm going to lean that way. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you about the viability of the Nationals. I mean, just because I'm bullish on the Giants doesn't mean I have to dump on the other team.
You wouldn't be surprised then, right? I mean, if it turned out to be the Nats, yeah.
No, because you pointed out, I mean, the Nationals have a lot of what it takes to win, a lot of what it takes to go deep into the postseason. They have, really good starting pitching. They have a diversified offense. They have a manager whom I like. I mean, I know there's opinions vary on Dusty Baker, but I think he's a good manager, and players love him. That's the most important thing. They love playing for him. So you have a bunch of things going for the Nationals. They're certainly legitimate, but I just think I just give the Giants the edge based on their performance in the postseason over the last 5 years.
Last thing, Dennis, and we got to run. We continue with Dennis Mantloff doing a preview of the second half of the Major League Baseball season. We are live here at Highland Meadows at the Marathon Classic in Sylvania. It's just a phenomenal event. Dennis, one more question before you go on those Giants and on the National League. If Clayton Kershaw comes back sooner rather than later, and is Clayton Kershaw, who was having, what do you want to call him? You want to call him Koufax? You want to call him Gibson? You want to call him the greatest pitchers having the greatest types types of seasons in baseball history. 145 strikeouts to 9 walks, for crying out loud. A microscopic ERA. He means so much to that club in every way, even though he only pitches every fifth day. It's kind of the conversation we used to have about Verlander with Detroit. It changes the way every team approaches series with them. If he comes back healthy and the same dominant guy, and we don't know what it's going to be, can they close the gap with the Giants to even, you know, edge them out of that division title?
I suppose. I don't know, for whatever reason, Bob, I don't love the Dodgers like some people do. I know they have pieces that look good. They've got young pieces that are in veterans. I mean, they can pitch a little bit. They got Kershaw, if he's healthy at the top. And who else would you want other than Bumgarner, you know, running the show at the top of a rotation in the playoffs? So the Dodgers are good if they're healthy, but I don't know. I just put them a cut below the Giants, even if Kershaw returns.
Yeah, and that's certainly fair. And everything you described in your pick of the Giants as being the best team in the National League is certainly valid. I wouldn't challenge any of it. I just feel like, I don't know why, but I feel like the Dodgers have a run in them if and when they get Kershaw back. I don't think it's going to be San Francisco. They're up 6.5, just like the Indians are over the Tigers and the Royals. And that's a pretty healthy lead. I feel like the Dodgers have a run. I feel like head-to-head, especially if Kershaw is there. Well, let me ask you this. In a head-to-head matchup, and it's Kershaw against Bumgarner, we know in October Kershaw has not been at his best, and we know that Bumgarner has been legendary. But going down the stretch in a season like this, who would you take if you could have only one of those guys?
I know some of the people say that I'm an idiot for saying it, but I would go with Bumgarner.
You would?
You know, yeah, I'm not. It's a tough question. And look, Kershaw is fantastic, but Bumgarner in the postseason or down the stretch is just an animal. And I know there's stats that show that Kershaw is much better than people have thought in clutch situations and in the postseason. I am not saying I wouldn't want Kershaw as a 1A choice. But to me, if I had to start one game that meant everything to my season, whether it be to clinch a playoff spot or to avoid elimination
in
the playoffs.
Dennis, I get that, and I don't disagree. If I had to start one game, too, I would, too. That's why my question was down the stretch. To close the gap, to win a division, you know, for the 2.5 months that you need them, I think I would go Kershaw. For the one game, I'm with you. Bumgarner has...
Hey, Bob.
To win a division, okay. I think I'd go Kershaw.
Okay. All right. Look, you can't go wrong either way. You know, I think you're in good shape either way, but I just have a preference for Bumgarner, I guess.
Yeah, and that's perfectly legitimate. Looking at his numbers, they're not terribly much less impressive than Kershaw's, but they are. They're less. Kershaw's just an animal. Kershaw is just a regular season animal that we have not seen maybe in, I don't know, a long, long time. And I'm going further back than Clemens and Randy Johnson and other guys who have just been spectacular. I'm talking about historic-type stuff that he is doing and has done, and I hope he gets back. I'm not even a Dodger fan. I'm just I'm very appreciative of that kind of dominance, you know what I mean?
Well, Bob, let me throw this in, too. Kershaw can handle the bat, but he's not on Bumgarner's level, okay? The thing about Bumgarner that makes him even more fascinating, well, I mean, he's a guy who actually creates 9 positions in the order that you have to pitch to in the National League. I mean, he's that good of a hitter. I mean, I was reading some stat on Twitter. I'm reading some stat on Twitter that Bumgarner has as many home runs in, I think, his last 295 plate appearances as Giancarlo Stanton. You know, not including the home run derby. But, you know, in regular season games, I think they each have 11 in their last 295 or 285 plate appearances. I mean, Bumgarner is that dangerous of a hitter. So when he's pitching, you have to treat him like a regular hitter.
I will give you that. That is a very good point. And if you are looking at the whole game in that regard, making it another spot in the order you don't have to take for granted as an easy out against, you're right. That gives him an edge for that game that you're talking about. And you can't go wrong with it. Dennis, great analysis as always. So you're seeing essentially a Rangers and Giants World Series at this stage right now?
At this moment, yes.
Okay, that's all I want to hear. And that may change after the deadline. We see who adds, who subtracts, who says we're in it, and who folds up the tent. That might change things, and we'll catch up with you again soon. Thanks very much, Dennis.
Thanks, Bob.
Dennis, you got it, buddy. Dennis Mandeloff joining us out there from Cleveland. He says, by the way, the Tigers are not done. He said it is going to be a two-team race in the American League Central, in his view, and that it's going to be the Indians and the Tigers fighting it out for that division championship. The Indians obviously start out with a pretty healthy lead at the starting tape, if you want to call tomorrow the starting tape of the second half. Who will make it to the finish line? Well, 6.5 games to make up is not going to be easy for the Tigers, but Dennis says they are still a threat in Detroit. Okay. Going to get a timeout here. I want to remind you, though, of something very, very cool going on. If you want to attend the biggest motorcycle rally on earth, Sturgis, we have got a tremendous opportunity for you. The winner of this contest will get airfare, a cabin stay for two at the Pappy Hotel campground, and side stage seats. And you can meet and greet. You'll have meet and greet passes for Jackal, Black Label Society, Zach Wild. All you got to do to qualify for this Sturgis flyaway is text the word rally, R-A-L-L-Y, to 64636, and you will qualify for the grand prize drawing, a trip to Sturgis. Good luck from Toledo's ESPN 106.5, the ticket. All right, we're going to get a sports center right now. Then we're going to come back. We got one segment to go before we turn it over to Mike Miller. We are both live here at Highland Meadows in Sylvania for the Marathon Classic, brought to you by 1 Hour Heating and Air Conditioning and Ben Franklin Plumbing on the ticket. We'll try to open up the phone lines as well. I know we've been very busy and haven't done much of that this show, but we'll try to get you on. If you've got thoughts on any of the topics we've covered thus far, or the classic itself right here, 866-240-1065 is the number. Right back with you on the extravaganza after this.
France, ESPN 106.5, the ticket.
And we do indeed continue, we continue live here at Highland Meadows in Sylvania. The Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza live from the Marathon Classic. You just got the leaderboard update from Jim Cushlin. We are brought to you by 1 Hour Heating and Air Conditioning and Ben Franklin Plumbing. Both of them, thank you so much for your support of this program here at Highland Meadows. It is an absolutely perfect day. The media here all working in comfortable temperatures, covering this great tournament with all the great athletes, and doing it with really the best pros in the business. And by that I mean the hosts of the Marathon Classic. The hospitality is first class and first rate. So glad to be here. I know Mike Miller is, because he's been here all week, and he's going to be here tonight and tomorrow as well. He'll be coming your way in about 8 or 9 minutes after we get to the top of the hour Sports Center. Jim Cushlin, we talked a lot of baseball this last 40 minutes or so with Dennis Mandeloff. What was your, I don't recall, at the beginning of the season, what was your call for American and National League World Series teams?
Oh, the World Series teams. I know I probably would have leaned towards, because I don't remember making that call. I remember the division because I thought it would be Kansas City again. But in terms of the pennant, I know I was leaning towards the Royals because I thought the American League was up in the air still.
Yep.
And as for National League, I was somewhere between the Giants and I think the Cubs, because I knew the Cubs.
I thought you said Cubs.
I may very well have. I honestly can't remember pennant at this point, but I know the NL would have been down to Cubs or Giants, because you know the Giants are in an even year, and I thought the Cubs had taken that step forward last year to maybe take another step forward this year. The Royals, we've been burned on that one the last 2 years.
You're right. You keep forgetting about them, and all they do is go out there and destroy September and win the division, and then go into October and wreck everybody's predictions. Because nobody picked the Royals the last couple of years, and they went to two straight series. The reason I asked Jim, obviously, is the same question I asked to Mandeloff. Are you rethinking things now? Are you looking at the best team in the American League, the best team in the National League? And I'll answer it first, because I always ask you guys and then put you on the spot, and sometimes we forget to ask me. I've got the same kind of feeling Dennis does about the Rangers, but the Boston Red Sox, to me, are still built the best to win a very competitive American League East. And while I want to say the pitching of the Indians will be enough, to get them there through not just the division over the Tigers, but to get them through October and go to the World Series. I don't feel like their young bats, which have done wonders for them in the streak that they had and everything else, will be able to handle the primetime lights of October. So I get Dennis's Texas, and I really want to say the Indians, yeah. But I think Boston is going to be the team that ends up coming out of the East and the team that I do not want to have to face if I'm in the AL, in the American League playoffs. I'm going with Boston to win the flag, at least as of July 14, still 17 days from the deadline. And in the National League, you heard me making my case. I heard everything he said about the Giants, and I can certainly still believe the Cubs, who have fallen on hard times in the last 2 weeks before the break. They certainly are the real deal. But I'm going with the Nats. I think they are the most complete team offensively and then in the starting and bullpen pitching spots. What do you think in the NL?
In the NL right now, I see no reason to change it. In fact, I'll even word it as the NLCS matchup. Right now, I see no reason to change it. I like Cubs and Giants in the NL. Not as high on Boston. I'm higher on Texas, who, by the way, I think D-Man mentioned this. They're getting you Darvish back over the weekend. I like an ALCS of the Indians and the Rangers because the Indians starting pitching is that good, and we'll see if that really matters in October like we've all been taught.
Well, first of all, it does matter. You're going to have to score some runs. I mean, Corey Kluber is a living example of that. He's been great for so many starts in the last couple of years, but obviously it's just not... getting the run support a lot of times. So in the playoffs, obviously he's going to have that. And I just feel like that might be a deal breaker for the Indians offensively when the young kids need to perform in October the way they performed in April through August or September. But I'm not going to let you get away with this. And if you're playing music because we're out of time, I can't hear it. I apologize, Jim. So just real quick, you said I'm not backing off of Giants and Cubs, but unless they allow teams to combine rosters at the in the baseball playoffs, you don't get Giants and Cubs. You get Giants or Cubs. You got to pick one, tough guy.
Giants, then. It's the even number year thing. It's the same principle as the Royals that we've been betting against. It's an even number year. That means Giants, right?
That is a fair point. And you know what? That's as good as that. You know, it's funny. Maniloff didn't mention that as he was making the case for the Giants. And he made a very solid case without that little kind of quirk the way it's been for the San Francisco Giants. All right. Jim, thanks very much. Thanks again to everybody out here at Highland Meadows. Just a tremendous event, a tremendous day, weather and otherwise. Thanks to the hosts and thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to Mike Miller for helping get everything.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.